We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is the producer. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour. Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. In the first half of this year, there have been hundreds of attacks against websites in the United States, including sites of major companies and also the government. President Obama has said that the growing number of cyber attacks is among the most serious economic and national security threats that our nation faces. This morning in this hour, we'll try to talk a little bit about this problem, cyber security. Cyber crime, cyber terrorism. Talk a little bit about who the attackers are, where this comes from, who's responsible, and perhaps what's being done to try to defeat them, or at least to make computer systems more robust. And our guest for the program is Brad Schaaf. He is the Chief Security Officer at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, based here on the campus of the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's responsible for both physical and cyber operational security for the center. Before going to work at NCSA, he was a special agent with the FBI. He was a senior cybercrime specialist. He worked in criminal matters, counterterrorism, counterintelligence. He was a certified digital forensic examiner and also a member of the FBI's computer analysis response team. So he's got quite a lot of experience working in this area. As we talk, questions are welcome. I know he will do his best to answer the questions that come in. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you have email, you want to send in your question that way, you could do it as well. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point, you can give us a call. Thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome. I appreciate you inviting me.
Early in one of the things I read, I think thought this was just a remarkable statistic. There was a survey done by an outfit called the Peineman Institute that they do a lot of research on the subject of information security policy. And this survey came out early in June, and they said that they found out that 90% of businesses in the United States had experienced a cybersecurity breach in the past 12 months. So that's 9 out of 10. And they said 59% said that they had two or more, and that people were saying they thought the frequency of these attacks had gone up. We know that companies have been attacked. We know that the U.S. government has been attacked. The Defense Department in this spring apparently had one of the worst attacks ever, where some foreign government got information through getting at a contractor. So we know it's a big problem, and it seems to be getting worse. Why do you think it is that, like, say, there's been a big increase in this kind of activity just in the last year?
Well, I think some of it, you know, and I certainly don't want to minimize the problem, but I think some of it is probably due to a greater awareness of the issue. Right. I mean, with any statistics, you always have reporting problems, right? Are we actually seeing more of these, or are people just reporting them more often? But I do think that certainly the awareness of the activity is on the rise. I think that people are becoming more and more aware of how important their digital assets are and the value of the information that they oftentimes, without a ton of forethought, place in the hands of their digital systems. And so they're becoming more in tune to paying attention to what's going on with those systems. But I also think there's an increasing awareness on the other side, on the bad guy side, of that same fact, right? That most of the valuable information that anyone possesses is probably available in some sort of computer or digital format somewhere. And that most people place that information into that format without a ton of forethought being given to the security of it, as opposed to where we might put other things that we traditionally recognize as valuable, money or other articles that sort of hold their value physically. We give some forethought as to where we put those and how secure they may be. We oftentimes don't do that with information, And yet information can lead to access to those very same things.
Yeah. There has been, I think for some time now, there have been people who are saying that there's a national security angle to this.
Sure.
And that the government needs to protect its assets, but also so does private industry.
Right.
And so it seems that countries are starting to think about the issue of cyber security as being part of their security. And I'm sure that they're thinking both in a defensive way and in an offensive way, that needs to be part of their thinking about defense. We know that there are people who would want to do damage this way so that their intent would be malicious and they could be state or they could be non-state actors.
Sure.
At the same time, it seems that there are people who have simply discovered – people who you would simply say were criminals
mm-hmm. –
and have discovered, well, this is a way to make money. You know, I know I came across somebody who was a computer security expert and said, well, one of the big changes is that criminals have discovered the internet. And so you wonder, the kind of thing that we're talking about, how much of this might be people who were simply motivated by a criminal objective. They're just wanting to make some money this way.
Sure. Well, I think there's an enormous number of those people. I mean, there's – if you look just recently over the last few months at the arrests that have been made by different federal law enforcement organizations just within this country and then also in conjunction with foreign law enforcement agencies, the amount of money that some of these criminal organizations have made through cybercrime has been in the tens of millions of dollars. So there's plenty of money to be made. And I think one of the key aspects of this that I think folks – don't realize and therefore adds a little bit more scariness, if you will, to cybercrime is that there really is – there's no new crime here. Okay? If you stop and think about it, you don't do anything on a computer that you didn't do before you had a computer really. I mean I'm old enough. I'm going to presume you're old enough to remember that the days before the internet when everything was not done on a computer and, yeah. and you may go through an entire day unless you had something to do with your job where you didn't sit down at a computer. But we watched movies before then. We listened to music. We were entertained. We sent messages. We wrote documents. We communicated in general, both business and personally. We remembered each other's birthdays. I mean, somehow we managed all of that prior to the rise of the internet, if you will, and the systems that operate on it. And so while certainly from a multimedia perspective, capabilities have skyrocketed with the advent of cyber technology and it being pushed out across our culture, really hasn't changed the things that we enjoy doing and the things that are valuable to us as people. And that has had a similar effect on criminals. Criminals are doing the same things they've always done. They're gaining access to things that don't belong to them. And they're either taking them away or they're leveraging them for their own purposes in order to make money one way or another, whether they're taking something of value directly or they're putting you in a position where you're giving them something of value that you wouldn't otherwise give them. And that same principle applies both to sort of nation state espionage as well as industrial espionage. I mean, foreign states have always been after each other's secrets and competitive companies have always been after each other's secrets. The difference today is that those secrets tend to reside on computer systems that are networked, and any computer system that is networked is, to one degree or another, available across that network. And so instead of seeing, guys in trench coats exchanging notes in a subway station, you've got spies from foreign countries sitting in the comfort of their own offices or homes and being able to reach out and access data that is thousands of miles away and do it in milliseconds or thousands of a second. So that is certainly a difference. The access and the methodology is different, but the objective and the goals of both criminals and spies or terrorists remains the same, just sort of a different route to the same result.
Yeah. Well, it seems that really the thing that makes these systems useful is also the thing that makes them vulnerable. So if you have, say, for example, if you had a power plant and you just wanted to make sure no one could mess around with your systems, well, you could design a system that was completely closed off from the outside world.
Right.
But that, for a lot of reasons, you don't want to have a system that's completely closed off from the outside world. So the thing is, you know, how do you manage that access so that you have the security level that you want, and yet you have it possible to, for people to get in there and do what they need to do?
Right. Well, that's one of the lead-ins all the time. I'm talking to someone with a digital system that they want to secure, and they're asking me how to do that. And I say, well, I can make it completely secure. Just give me a second. I'll reach for the plug. I'll say, if I unplug this, you're going to be completely secure. But you're also going to find that your system is completely useless. And so what we have to do is we have to find a medium in there somewhere where you can use the system as it was designed for whatever purpose you want to use it for, but do it in as secure a fashion as possible. And what that boils down to essentially is risk management. Mm-hmm. I mean, how much risk are you willing to assume with this particular system as a trade-off to its usability? So if all you're using a system for is gaming or, you know, some sort of entertainment, and there's no particular information of value to you, certainly if it didn't work, you know, that would, you'd be bummed out and you wouldn't be able to do what you want to do with it. But it wouldn't cause a significant issue for you personally. Well, then maybe you don't need a ton of security on that, and maybe you can exchange, you know, more bandwidth and you know, more capability with less security. Conversely, on the systems, you know, one would hope on, for instance, for banking and financial systems, and certainly systems that belong to our government or classified work that contractors may be doing for the government. You know, those systems, perhaps we can't afford as much risk, and therefore we need to box the usability in a little bit more in order to ensure that it is as secure as it needs to be in order to get the job done, but not provide unnecessary or unnecessary access to some sort of malicious actor.
Yeah. Well, just I have some callers here I get right too. I think about if you use the lock as a metaphor, you know, think back in the days when the way you made something secure was you put a lock on it. Mm-hmm. You can always develop new locks, but there's always going to be somebody who, either because they just want to get in or for the fun of it, they're going to want to pick that lock. Right. So is that the case with this, that you're all, in a sense, that you're always developing new locks because there's always somebody who, for whatever reason, is going to put whatever energy it takes to defeating your system?
Sure. I mean, up to a point, you know, that old phrase, better locks make better thieves, right? I mean, you design a better lock and eventually someone's going to figure that out and he's going to be a better thief. But you know, I love to use real-world analogies for things like this because I really like for people to think in terms of, you know, not the computer changing everything, but simply being a different way of performing things that we've you know, in most cases always performed. You know, most people live relatively securely and relatively confidently within their houses at a certain level of security. I mean, and I think that's what you're always trying to achieve is, where is that happy medium? If I have a decent deadbolt on my house and I lock my windows at night, is that going to prevent some, you know, highly dedicated, highly trained group of individuals from getting in my house? Absolutely not. But the likelihood of a group like that wanting to get in my house is low. So I don't really need to worry about that. Conversely, if, you know, I'm a bank or I'm a you know, a secure vault of some sort, and there's a recognized threat to me, and that increases the risk, then I perhaps need to start looking at some more advanced locks. And then I think to a certain extent at that level, it does become a little bit of an arms race, right? Now, I put this lock on, you pick it, got to come up with a new lock. So I do think that happens.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is Brad Schaaf. He is the Chief Security Officer for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications on the U of I campus. And we're talking about cybersecurity, and have a couple of callers here. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign, line one.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
My question is somewhat related to what you're talking about, but I have, years ago, at least 10 years ago, have heard my scientist friends referring to Internet 2, that the real scientists didn't even use the first Internet anymore for their, you know, publications, that kind of thing. They use Internet 2. What is Internet 2? And if it's a separate entity, why don't corporations and the government use the Internet too? Obviously, I'm no scientist at all. Or is there just one way to get bandwidth, period, and that's why we have so many security problems.
Well, I appreciate you calling. That's a good question. Internet 2 does exist. It is a portion of the Internet. It is a dedicated network that is in place for scientists and researchers to use. However, I think more to the gist of your question as to why doesn't the government or folks who have a desire to protect their network resources, why don't they use more dedicated resources, is the number one answer is cost. I mean, one of the reasons why some of our critical resources and assets have transferred to the Internet is simply because it's efficient, it's effective, and it's very low cost. I mean, you're not going to go back and find any decision that was made by the government where someone officially rang a bell and said, today we move off of older technology or more dedicated technology and onto the Internet. It has just slowly happened over time because it is a better way of moving data than the old ways. The problem is that because that's just sort of happened over time, oftentimes that's done without a good, clear recognition of what the threats may be. So there are a number of ways that you can create dedicated networks between systems, even using the public Internet. There's things that are called virtual LANs. And essentially what happens is data is encrypted on one end and then it's sent across the public Internet, but it's in an encrypted form so that if someone were to be able to see that traffic for one reason or another, they wouldn't be able to read it. And then when it gets to the point where it's supposed to be, theoretically, then that person has the ability to unencrypt it and read it. And so you get the benefit of being able to use the network infrastructure that's in place, but do it in a much more private fashion. So within the government, within organizations that have a requirement for that, that sort of technology is commonly used. But like all technology, it has to be used well. There has to be rules in place about how people are going to use it, when they use it, what the requirements are to get on that network and how careful they are with it. And for the most part, particularly with folks who are engaged in espionage, they're very patient. And eventually someone makes a mistake and they're usually there to take advantage of that mistake.
I see. I'm just surprised that at least the military doesn't use that type of communication. I mean, that it is still vulnerable to hacking. Or is it the same thing, that eventually somebody makes a mistake, et cetera, and somebody can get in?
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, the military certainly does use very advanced technology in order to try and protect its communications and its data storage systems, and has for years and years. But again, as David was referring to earlier, there were 24,000 files that were sensitive in one way or another that were stolen this spring from a Department of Defense contractor. So, in this country, we rely heavily on private industry in support of our government programs, be they defense or space or communications or any other program. And so the quality of the security that surrounds those systems is only as good as the contractor, just like any chain with its weakest link. Mm-hmm. And again, one of the things that the advent of very rapid international communications through the Internet and computer systems has brought is the ability of someone to sit in a foreign country in the comfort of their own environment with all the time in the world and poke and poke and poke and poke until they can find a hole. Mm-hmm. And that is a change from the way things were done prior to the rise of the Internet as the primary use of communications and the technology that supports what we think of as the Internet.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. And it certainly is the case, as far as governments are concerned, is that they, as part of now, as you said before, governments have always spied. They've always done espionage, trying to get find out things that in secret information that other governments have. Mm-hmm. Well, now one of their spying tools is the Internet, essentially. Mm-hmm. As you've said, they have people that's what they do. That's their job. They spend all of their time all day long doing that, looking for ways to get in places where our government or maybe some big defense contractor or some industry doesn't want them to get. they're spending all their time doing that poking.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, again, it used to be a much more, you know, even when I started in law enforcement, you know, if a bank was robbed or someone was hurt or injured, you had a reasonable expectation that at the time the crime occurred, the bad guy was there. I mean, that he was physically present. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to rob the bank or rob the person or commit whatever crime he committed. You've removed that requirement for, you know, physical locality now with the way that the internet works and the way that, you know, digital communications work. So now you don't have to be there, and you don't have to make the effort of blending into your surroundings and not being recognized early on. But some of the truths about investigation remain. I mean, if you were physically there, you left evidence. When you are digitally there or virtually there, you also leave evidence. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why you see the government now focusing strongly on trying to acquire the expertise within the government, with all branches of the government, certainly in private industry, to have cybersecurity experts there who can not only help identify the holes before bad guys can take advantage of them, but to help patch those holes subsequent to some sort of crime or event occurring, and then work to make sure that at least that same hole is not going to be leveraged again. And so, you know, in the same way that we raised up a generation of counter-espionage, counterintelligence experts, criminal investigators that were working in largely in the physical world, we, you know, you see the government beginning to focus, and I think wisely so, on raising up a generation of investigators and counterintelligence, counterterrorism experts that can work in that virtual realm.
Okay. Let's talk with some other folks here. Indiana is next. Line 4. Hello.
Hello. Two things. I think refers to what the lady just talked about a few days ago or whatever. There was a talk about the Department of Defense was hacked into. And I remember for a short time the news people talked about they were going to take precautions to stop that, but also become offensive. And I immediately had in my mind that somebody pressed a button and that dude who ever did the hacking, all his computer equipment just disappeared in a big boom. I didn't know if that's what they meant, but I was wondering what the offensive structure is. And secondly, a number of years ago when I was involved with eBay and a lot, there were always people sending you things that we need to know your number, this and that, your bank account is screwed up somehow or another. That seemed pretty obvious to me, but I often wonder why people couldn't just do the eBay page or whatever without having some sort of they always said there was look in the corner for this or that. If it's not there, then you're being in danger of being hacked into. I wonder if you could talk to those two issues. Thank you.
Okay.
Sure. Well, to address the first issue about the more offensive capabilities, I mean, again, very recently in the press, the Department of Defense has come out and declared cyberspace to be, you know, its own independent operational arena, right? You know, much like land warfare, or sea warfare, or air warfare, and, you know, space warfare, and now we have cyber warfare as its own expertise. And quite frankly, I think that's just sort of a codification of something that's happened that has been the truth, that has been reality over a long period of time. And even prior to being in the FBI, I was in the military, and even way back then, there was a lot of talk about information warfare and how to manage both defensively and offensively our own information. And interestingly, you know, the United States being a highly technical society and culture, we're very susceptible to an attack on our technology. You know, a less technologically advanced culture, you know, doesn't care what sort of offensive capabilities you have. If they're going to move their troops with, you know, flags and bugles and FM radios, your cyber offensive capabilities don't hold near the threat that they might if we're turned around against us. We rely heavily upon our advanced communications technology to conduct warfare the way that we currently conduct it. So I think that there really is no difference from that offensive perspective that you would see in any other aspect of warfare. I mean, when you're fighting on the ground, you have concerns about your defensive position. You also have concerns about how to take and hold territory that your adversary holds or prevent him from moving his troops or from resupplying them or any of those things. And I think you can, again, lay that analogy down in cyberspace. I mean, certainly to the extent that we're at war with another entity, to the extent that we can cut off their communications, that we can keep them from understanding what different components of their forces are doing, we're going to take steps to do that. I am also certain that the Department of Defense would love to have a button that they could press and have some bad guy's computer equipment blow up while sitting on his desk. Maybe they do. Can't say that they don't, but I think really that the concept behind that is simply saying, recognizing where your adversary's weaknesses are, recognizing where you can take advantage of those, and then taking advantage of them just like you would in any other aspect of warfare. As to the pages that you're talking about, we refer to those as phishing sites. And as opposed to being phishing with an F, it's phishing with a PH. And that goes back to the old time. Sort of the origins of computer hacking actually come from hacking long-distance telephone lines. There were different ways a long time ago, over 20 years ago, really closer to 30 years ago now, where folks had developed ways by, you know, generating different signals or tones where you could get free long-distance telephone service. And that was referred to as phone, obviously with a PH, freaking with a PH. And so that concept is sort of carried forward into phishing sites with a PH. But the concept of phishing is the same, in that what the bad guy is trying to do is to sort of cast a net out there by mimicking a commercial site of some sort, of banking site or an eBay site or really almost any site, and then fooling you with that lure, if you will, to put your information onto that site, thinking that you're giving your information to a trusted third party, when in reality you're providing that information to a malicious user somewhere. And, you know, the colloquialism is that we're going to surf the web, we're going to go to a website. But you don't go to a website. A website comes to you. The data is delivered to your computer and displayed on your computer or device. And so phishing sites can be constructed out of components from the actual real site. The bad guys can go out and copy those different components, logos and photos and text, or actually just have them delivered sometimes even from the true third-party site. So those phishing sites can look very real. And I think that, you know, much like looking at a $20 bill and trying to decide whether or not it's counterfeit, you know, that route should be left to the experts. I mean, you're far better off taking an approach of does this seem right to me? Look, if it seems like it isn't right, it probably isn't right. You know, trust yourself to a certain extent with that. Also, you know, banks, financial institutions, eBay, PayPal, organizations like that are continually making it clear to their users that they're never going to ask you for your password. They're never going to ask you for your personal information in that sort of format. They're not going to want an email from you. They're not going to send you to a web page where, you know, they expect you to type that stuff in. So if you see things like that, you should immediately, if you've got your bank or financial institution or any other corporation that's asking you for personal information via their website, and you're not in the process of signing up for an account or something like that, where they're asking you, they're trying to convince you of something, your password is expired or we lost your data, you know, and please put it back in, you should immediately be suspect of that and contact that organization
and say to them, did you send me this message? And just before you do,
right, better safe than sorry.
Yeah, and then again, of course, and it's a standard advice as far as people with their own personal home computers go. You need to have some kind of antivirus protection, and you need to have good firewall so that only people that you authorize to go into your computer can. At least that's the idea of the firewall. Only the people you say, I am giving you permission to come into my computer. Only those people can then come into your computer.
Yeah, certainly you want to take advantage of all of the security features that your software, your operating system, or whatever it may be, provide. And I think that as time goes by, software vendors are doing a better job of developing those and also doing a better job of describing what those features are and how they work to users who are not computer experts. And so it is certainly worth spending a few minutes when you're, you know, sitting down at your computer, particularly if it's a new computer, one that you're just getting started with, spending some time and reading the information that's been provided about those things. Don't expect anyone to become an expert in antivirus or certainly an expert in how to configure a firewall so that only those connections that you desire to be made are made. That can be complicated technical work. Mm-hmm. But I think if you spend some time reading that information that the vendor provides, it'll give you some sense of how those things work and why they're there. And then you can make a decision as a user as to whether or not you want to put them into play.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus is Brad Chafe. He's the Chief Security Officer for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. We're talking about cyber security issues. We'll talk some more in a minute. This is Focus.
An Al-Qaeda operative believed to be a CIA informant detonated a suicide bomb inside a fortified military base, killing 7 CIA agents in late 2009. On the next Fresh Air, reporter Joby Warwick tells us about the man who carried out the attack and how he was able to pull it off. His new book is called Triple Agent. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here with different topics every day. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, the guest is Christian Parenti. He's contributing editor at The Nation, also visiting scholar at City University of New York. And we'll talk about his book, Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change, and the New Geography of Violence. Also tomorrow, Celeste Quinn hosts the second hour. Her guest historian, Gary Scott Smith. And they will talk about some of the ideas you'll find in his book, Heaven in the American Imagination. Then on Thursday at 10, we'll talk about Easter Island. I'm sure most people have seen these remarkable pieces of sculpture that exist on that island and have wondered, why did those people make those? What did it mean to them? Well, that's some of the questions we'll take up as we talk with archaeologist Carl Lippo from Cal State Long Beach, and he is the author of a book on that. The title is The Statues That Walked, Unraveling the Mystery of Easter Island. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon and 10 different topics, and you can find out what we're doing by going to our website. You can also listen to past programs, those that you might have missed, at WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, we're talking with Brad Schaaf. He is the Chief Security Officer for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications, based on the campus of the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. Before going to work at NCSA, he was a special agent with the FBI, working in the areas of cybercrime, counterterrorism, counterintelligence. He was a certified digital forensic examiner, also a member of the FBI's Computer Analysis Response Team. And we're talking about the issue of cybersecurity. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's another caller. Someone here where we are, Champaign County, line 2. Hello.
Hi. I always like to turn the tables and look at what other people could say about the U.S.'s role in sabotage and cyber attacks, and I have a list of three here that I know of, and there was a logic bomb inserted into the Trans-Siberian pipeline control mechanism during 82, during Casey's rule at the CIA during the Reagan administration. There's an accusation in the Latin American press that SAIC and CIA were involved in sabotaging Venezuelan refinery and pipeline systems by inserting similar sort of corrupting software into it. And most recently, I guess, I know of is the Stuxnet thing into the systems of the centrifuge systems of the Iranians. So I don't know if that was done remotely or whether that was done in a package, but it's still the same piece. And to see the U.S. so aggressively saying that they would record any attack on its infrastructure as something they could respond to with conventional and perhaps other weapons, it just strikes me as, I don't think you'd have the same valence to it that I would. I find it it's more do as we say and not as we do sort of admonitions to the rest of the world. So I just wanted to bring it up, and perhaps other people who are listening can search that out if they care to. But there's not much in English on the SAIC involvement with the time of the oil stoppages in Venezuela a while back. I don't have any idea how you react to this. I assume you'll attack me for being a communist or something, but I'll just leave it hanging in the air. But I'll hang on and see if there's anything you'd like to ask me about.
Well, I don't know in what way you might want to respond. I suppose the question is, you know, is it fair for the United States to say, we'll attack somebody if they attack us when we've already done it, if we allegedly have already done it?
Well, I think that, you know, I mean, far from being a communist, that's one of the great things about this country, right, is you are welcome to have your opinion, and I applaud that. I mean, do your own research and take whatever perspective you choose to take and you know, go vote. But as in response to the question, I guess my answer would be turnabout is fair play. I mean, I'm not certain that what the United States government's policy is that, you know, you are not allowed to attack us. However, we can attack you with impunity. I think what they're saying is if you attack us, you know, we certainly reserve the right to respond. And I don't know that there's ever been a time in history where if you leveled an attack at an adversary, it was from the perspective that you didn't expect them to do anything about it. Hmm. Now, you know, certainly on the espionage side of the house, one of the goals, in my understanding, I've never, you know, worked on that side of the house, is that, you know, you want to be able to influence events in such a way that you feel will favor your side the most, and do it in such a way that it can't be attributable back to you. And I'm sure that that, you know, went on yesterday, it's going on today, it'll go on tomorrow. And when you get caught doing that, you get caught and you have to deal with the ramifications.
Mm-hmm. Well, how I don't know if this is what sort of answer you can give, but in terms of if we are to believe that the United States is using cyber tools or cyber weapons, if they believe that should be part of our warfighting capability. You talked earlier about how that might be directed against, a military adversary. Mm-hmm. So it would be you could see where it would be to your advantage if you were fighting somebody and say you could do something that would disrupt their battlefield communications. Well, you know, that would be obviously very useful. Or if you could do something that would, you know, you could push a button and suddenly all of their weapons just wouldn't work.
Right.
You could see something like that would be advantageous. There's that sort of thing, but there's also the thing that would be the equivalent of dropping a bomb on their capital, and that is, well, if you could do something where you say you could shut down all their power plants, you could shut down their telecommunications, you could shut down the infrastructure for their banking and financial networks,
sure,
which would be extremely disruptive. It could be, you know, somebody did that in the United States, it would kind of bring life in the country to a halt. Is the United States doing both of those, looking at both of those kinds of things?
Well, I certainly can't speak with any definiteness about that issue. Obviously, I can't speak for the U.S. or its government or you know, what they may or may not be doing. But I would be surprised, as with any other component of our military and our national security infrastructure, if we weren't looking at both ways to defend our own capabilities, as you say. I mean, we talked about earlier, we're very susceptible to attacks on our technology. I mean, we have become dependent on it. And, you know, there's, as I've discussed with folks in different times, you know, if you suddenly had to go back to trapping or killing and skinning and cooking and eating, or planting and harvesting and cooking and eating all of your food, you know, how many folks would be comfortable in that environment? I think not many. So certainly there's grave concerns with protecting our technology and that our culture rests upon. But I would be surprised if we weren't also taking strides, you know, both in the military and in the defense infrastructure, to come up with ways to disrupt an adversary's technology in that same way. I mean, to me, it seems to be two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. Right. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I'm sure that these are issues that we'll continue to talk about on the program. For this purposes of this conversation, we have about 10 minutes left. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And if you want to send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I think that the big maybe one of the big problems here, if you talk about vulnerability of infrastructure here in this country, if you're talking about things like, you know, water, power, banking, financial networks, telecommunications, so forth, that's all in private hands. It's all private industry. So what we're really doing is we're relying on them to take the appropriate steps to guarantee that those systems are, maybe you don't want to use the word like guarantee, to do what you can to try to make those systems safe. And the question is, are they in fact doing that?
Well, you raise the most interesting aspect of that question in saying that, you know, the government does not run those things. And, you know, I spent almost a quarter of a century working for the government in one capacity or another. So I have some background to make the following statement. I've said in a number of presentations I've given that, you know, the government does not own or run or manage the internet, which is why it works.
Right.
The last thing we would want would be for the government to take over the running and management of the internet. Mm-hmm. With that would come all of the baggage that comes with any government program. But it is different from other key pieces of our infrastructure. I mean, if you want to enter this country from a foreign country, then you're at least theoretically going to have to come through some government gateway. You know, at some point in time, you're going to run into a customs official. At some point in time, you're going to run into an immigration official, and they're going to ask you some questions and, you know, try to determine why you're here and whether or not they want to allow you to enter the country. That doesn't happen on the internet. I mean, you can be from any point on the globe to some point within the United States in thousandths of a second anytime you want without ever running into a customs computer or an immigration computer. So the government is required to work very closely with the private sector who has management responsibility over not only the infrastructure of the internet itself, but with then those other critical infrastructures that you mentioned, like water and power and finance, the financial sector, emergency services, all of those things, oil and gas, to work with all with that those private sectors to provide information allowing them to apply the appropriate level of security. So I sort of view it as it being the government's responsibility to ensure that the private sector understands the risk and understands the ramifications of not paying attention to that risk, and then to the extent possible to provide guidance in ways to mitigate that risk and encourage those companies to do so, and to the extent necessary, provide for ramifications if they don't. But as, like you say, the government doesn't own the internet and doesn't manage the internet. So it is a partnership. And I think that I can say absolutely that it is a priority for the government. Now, you know, as to the level of success, there's a lot of infrastructure in this country and a lot of it's getting old. And so it's going to be a process to modernize it and do it in a secure fashion. But I think there's no question that that's a priority. Yeah. For both the government and the private industry that manages those sectors.
Well, when you I know when you were working in the FBI, you would give presentations. So you would spend a lot of time talking to people about these particular issues. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that you talked to lots of different kind of people and industry groups and so forth. And did you find that they were – when you talked about these things to them, that they were aware of what the problem was? I mean, did they sometimes seem to be surprised, or was it that they knew that there was a problem but weren't exactly sure what the right way to approach it was?
I think kind of a combination of both. I think generally they're aware that there is the potential for a problem. Mm-hmm. I think they're oftentimes surprised at the level that the problem may rise to, or at some events that have already occurred within their sectors, you know, whether it be a competitor or some other similar vendor in their area. And so I think there is oftentimes a level of surprise, and you can see it even in the press, you know, as these different corporate organizations and governments suffer attacks that are oftentimes on the outskirts of their network. You know, I mean, I am amused sometimes. I see, well, the CIA got hacked. Well, okay, a web server that belonged to the CIA and was used for some public purpose was defaced. And you know, I mean, so that there's a far cry from that and all of the nation's secrets suddenly being made public. So I think you sort of have to read between the lines a bit as to actually what's gone on. But I do think that awareness is a good thing. I think that the government is making an effort as best it can to raise the level of awareness, to do a better job of providing concrete facts to companies. In the past, you know, when I was in the FBI, I've been accused of providing generalities but not facts because the information was classified or whatever. And I think there's being an effort being made to improve that, which I think will improve awareness overall and provide that motivation necessary for the private sector to take the steps it needs to take.
We got one more call, at least here. Somebody in Urbana. Line one. Hello?
Yeah, hello.
Yeah.
Why is it that I get the impression that our military excursions overseas are almost like a very select of rich boys playing with their war toys and having game plans and this, that, and the other thing. And then nearly every 5 to 10 years when we've built up a surplus of weapons of mass destruction, like our poison gas attack that we supplied to Saddam Hussein and the other obsolete and malfunctioning weapons that are scattered abroad because we don't dispose of them properly in this country.
I'm afraid that's well beyond the scope of this particular conversation. I'm not sure that's something that our guest can address.
Well, Well, I did hear a reference to fair play and what have you, and I don't see anything funny or as a game with any of the stuff.
Well, I first of all, I'm in no position to respond to any of that. I work at the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. I think the reference to fair play was made in, as a reference to the way nation states interact with each other. And, again, you're certainly welcome to your opinion as to the level of humor involved with that.
I'm afraid that's maybe about the best response we can do. We have about 5 minutes left in this hour of focus. Our guest is Brad Schaeff. He's the Chief Security Officer with the National Center for Supercomputing Applications based here on the campus of the university. He is the guy who's responsible for physical and cyber operational security for the center, and questions are welcome. Actually, something that is kind of interesting, when you talk about your concerns at NCSA, they're a little bit different perhaps than other kinds of organizations, because you're not so much about keeping secrets, because you don't really have secrets. I mean, people are doing their scientific work that sooner or later is going to be public. So it's not so much that's people are trying to break in there to see what you're doing, but you've got these tremendously powerful computers. So what it is you're just trying to prevent is someone taking advantage of the fact that, wouldn't it be swell if I had a supercomputer? Well, you've got one, and if I could get into yours and use it for whatever it is I wanted to do, that would be great.
Right. Well, certainly we want to protect the integrity of the systems. I mean, even though the information, in large part, the information that's being processed on those systems is being done in terms of scientific or academic research, and the advancement of science is the whole purpose of the supercomputing systems that NCSA manages and runs, should those systems not function as anticipated, or should they be skewed in one way or another, then the output of that research is obviously called into question. And so a great deal of time and a great deal of effort and a great deal of money is put into setting up that research and then running it through the supercomputers to get an output that you can rely upon. And we want to make that output as reliable as possible. So there's that aspect of protecting the systems from inappropriate or malicious use. Also, bad guys on the network are always looking for a place that has, a lot of bandwidth, a big pipe that they can get data back and forth from, and we've got some pretty good sized ones at NCSA. And also for, storage space, and we also have a great deal of storage space at NCSA. So, and then if nothing else, the sort of reputation boost that a hacker could get by saying, hey, I was able to gain access to, these high value, very powerful supercomputers that are, used for research purposes. And so certainly there is that aspect as well. So, our objective at NCSA, like any cybersecurity team, is to keep our systems, the three words you hear all the time are confidentiality, integrity, and availability. So we want our systems to be used only by the people that are authorized to use them, only for the purposes that they're authorized to be used for, and that for the output of those systems to be as reliable as possible.
Yeah. I wonder whether we have seen more and we're likely to see more hobbyist hackers, and the reason is that the tools, we've gotten past the point where you have to essentially make your own tools. Mm-hmm. You would have to have the expertise to develop the software and know how to use it, and that now those kinds of tools are actually fairly widely available, and that you don't need that level of skill to be able to, at least you don't, as I say, you don't have to build the tool in the first place.
Sure. I mean, that is a growing problem, that you need a base understanding of the technology and some ideas to what you'd like to achieve. Mm-hmm. And once you have those things, then oftentimes you can do a bit of research on the internet, oftentimes you can get it for free. Sometimes in sort of the gray market, you can actually purchase malicious software that will allow you to attack a system in a certain way to gain a certain level of access. So that's a growing problem, and I think we're going to see that problem continue. And then, like anything, I think that this is, for whatever reason, become a big issue in the press. It's become a more popular issue. It's become a more public issue. And any time that anything gets any publicity, that sort of pulls people out of the woodwork that say, oh, wow, that sounds neat and that sounds cool. Maybe I'd like to try that. And so I certainly think as long as publicity is a double-edged sword in that way, I think it's great in that it raises awareness. But I think we're also going to see a lot of folks saying, hey, I'd like to try my hand at that.
Well, it sounds as if it is a way of summing up the kind of thing that we're talking about. We're just going to see more of it. And as more and more people use computers for more things, mm-hmm. and that we're not going to stop storing valuable information in digital form and putting it somewhere. Well, as long as you say, as long as that's going to be somewhere and it does have value to one person, somebody else is going to think about, well, what can I get that and get out of it whatever there is. So it's something that the level of awareness for individuals, for government, for business is just going to have to increase, because it seems like, as I said at the beginning, it seems that the problem is continuing to get worse.
Yeah, I mean, much the same way as you wouldn't store your cash on the front porch of your house, I think people are going to, you know, start to recognize, hey, you know, this information that I'm putting on my computer system, whether it's about me personally or it's about my financial accounts or it's about my family or, you know, any other information is valuable. It has the same level of value as a more concrete physical thing like a money or, you know, jewels or something of that nature. And I think they're going to have to start paying attention to how do I properly secure that, right? I don't think paranoia is a good thing. I don't think, as you say, trying to run away from the technology and sort of, you know, put the toothpaste back in the tube, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. But understanding a little bit about what the risk is and how do I best mitigate that risk, just like we talked about. You don't have to turn your house into Fort Knox to keep, you know, yourself feeling safe and secure. And I think the same thing's true of your computer.
Mm-hmm. Well, our guest this morning in this hour, Brad Schaaf, he's the Chief Security Officer for the National Center for Supercomputing Applications here on the campus of the University of Illinois. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate it.